Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really going under the hood in robotics. Forget the shiny exterior. We're talking about the core infrastructure. You know, the stuff that makes a robot actually work reliably in the real world, not just in a lab. We've got sources covering the whole stack today. We'll get into new data standards like NCAP. Then there's the big shift in communication architecture with ROS2 and FastDDS. We'll also touch on some surprisingly tricky Docker configuration details that trip people up. And finally, we'll look at the really advanced stuff, the deterministic control system in the Atlas framework.
That's right. And our mission here is really to cut through the jargon. You know, we want to pull out the key insights, the operational why behind these changes. So you can understand why things like decentralized communication, index data, this hybrid control, why they're so critical for building autonomous systems that are, well, robust, scalable, and actually reliable. Okay, let's unpack this.
All right, let's start with the foundation.data. Robots just produce enormous amounts of it, don't they? LiDAR, cameras, sensors, logs.
Yeah.
It's all different types of data. And the old ways, like the traditional ROS bags, they just weren't really cut out for this scale and mix, especially with huge sensor feeds.
Yeah, exactly. And the industry's answer, which is fascinating, is MCAP. That's MCAP. It's a really significant step up. It's designed to be modular. It's high performance. And crucially, it's serialization agnostic. Think of it as a container built specifically for modern pub-sub systems.
Okay, serialization agnostic.
Hmm.
What does that actually mean for someone working with it compared to the old bags?
Well, the key thing is its structure. MCAP lets you bundle different kinds of data in one file. So you can have your standard ROS messages, sure, but also protobuf, JSON metadata, even raw sensor streams, all neatly packaged together. But the real game changer, I think, is how it's optimized for indexed reading and remote seeking.
Remote seeking. So accessing data stored somewhere else, like in the cloud.
Precisely. Think about debugging a robot fleet. All that data probably ends up in cloud storage, maybe S3, right? With MCP's indexing, you don't need to download a massive multi-gigabyte file just to look at, say, a few seconds of sensor data from Tuesday afternoon.
Huh, okay, so you can just pull the specific chunk you need.
Exactly. You seek directly to the timestamp or topic you care about. That efficiency is huge.
Yeah.
And that's why ROS2 officially adopted it as the default format, starting with the Iron Irwin-y release back in May 2023.
And that efficiency naturally leads to better tooling, right? Like
right.
Foxglove Studio for visualization. We see the operational payoff there with its smooth integration with S3 compatible storage.
Absolutely. The old workflow was painful, wasn't it? You'd copy huge files locally, wait maybe hours, then you could finally start debugging.
Hmm.
Now, teams can store, you know, petabytes of MCP files in their data lake, and they can stream just the relevant window of data directly from S3 into Foxglove.
Without downloading the whole thing.
Without downloading the whole thing. The scalability, the accessibility, the durability you get with cloud storage, it's a massive improvement for large deployments. You can instantly investigate some weird glitch that happened yesterday on a robot halfway across the world just by streaming that index slice of data.
That ability to instantly access huge data sets is definitely a powerful base. Okay, so let's shift gears from stored data to the real-time flow. Communication. This is where you said it gets really interesting, the jump from ROS1 to ROS2.
Oh, yeah. It's a fundamental architectural change.
Yeah.
ROS1 was, well, centralized. Everything revolved around the ROS master node. The master handled discovering other nodes, setting up connections. It worked, but it had a major flaw.
The single point of failure.
Exactly. The SPOF. Mm-hmm. If that ROS master went down, your whole robot system could just grind to a halt. Plus, it didn't really have robust security built in or sophisticated quality of service options.
Okay, so ROS2 threw that out. It uses DDS data distribution service. You mentioned this is used in critical systems.
That's right. DDS is an industry standard. Think air traffic control, industrial control, defense systems. It's designed for high reliability.
Yep.
And the core difference when you ditch the master, you get decentralized discovery.
No central coordinator.
Nope. Nodes find each other directly, peer-to-peer, using standard DDS discovery protocols. This inherently makes the system more resilient. There's no single node whose failure takes down communication. And DDS brings other benefits too, like built-in security options, authentication, encryption, and really fine-grained quality of service or QoS settings.
QoS, so you can control things like reliability.
Exactly. You can specify per topic, do messages absolutely have to get through, reliable? Is it okay if some are dropped, best effort? How long should data be kept for late joiners, durability? It's highly configurable for different needs, like real-time control versus, say, logging.
That sounds incredibly powerful, much more robust. But if it's all decentralized, how does discovery actually work efficiently, especially in big networks? Or what if you do want some kind of initial rendezvous point?
That's a good point. While peer-to-peer is the default, DDS implementations like FastDDS, which is the default middleware in ROS2, they also support other modes. One common one is the discovery server mode. This is kind of a compromise. You have designated servers that help nodes find each other initially, which can be more efficient in some network setups or when you need to cross subnets.
Okay, so you get the robustness of DDS, but can still manage discovery if needed. And FastDDS is the specific implementation we're usually dealing with in ROS2.
Correct. And there are actually two main RMW layers, ways ROS2 interacts with FastDDS. There's ARM Fast3EP SCP, which is usually the default. It tends to be faster because it maps message types at build time. Then there's ARM Fast3EP Dynamic Tab, which is more flexible because it can handle message types discovered at runtime, but with a bit more overhead.
Right. And you mentioned configuring this specifically for that discovery server mode.
Yes, this is a really practical tip. If you want a client robot to find a specific server, you need to tell its FastDDS configuration about that server's IP address. Typically, this involves editing an XML configuration file. In one specific example we looked at, it's line 14 in a file like opt-galaxifine-server-super-client-configuration-file.xml. You put the server's IP there.
Okay, seems straightforward enough. Edit the file.
But here's the crucial part, the bit that often trips people up. After you change that XML file, you absolutely must restart the ROS2 daemon.
Why is that?
Because the daemon caches network information and discovery state. If you just change the file, the running daemon might still be using the old cached settings. So you run ROS2 daemon stock and then ROS2 daemon start. That forces it to reread the configuration and clear its cache. It sounds small, but forgetting this step can lead to hours of frustrating debugging, wondering why your nodes aren't connecting.
That's a great practical nugget. Definitely filing that one away. Okay, speaking of configuration frustrations, let's pivot slightly. Let's talk Docker. It's everywhere in robotics deployment now, but setting up the shell environment inside a container seems to cause a lot of headaches. Why?
Oh, absolutely. It's a classic pain point. It usually comes down to a misunderstanding about how shells work inside Docker, specifically during the build process. You know how on your normal Linux machine, you put environment variables and path setups in your .batch shirk file?
Right? Yeah, so they're available when you open a terminal.
Exactly. That terminal is usually an interactive shell, and interactive shells dutifully run bash shirk to set things up for you. But when Docker builds an image and it executes a run command in your Docker file,
it's not interactive.
It's not interactive. It uses a non-interactive shell by default. And non-interactive shells are built for speed and scripting. They typically skip loading .bashshirk or etc. bash.bashcore profile scripts entirely.
Okay. So if you have a run source.bashshirk command in your Docker file to set up some paths,
it often just silently does nothing or doesn't have the effect you expect during that run one command or subsequent run commands. Because the shell executing run isn't the kind that reads bashshirk.
And just to clarify, that tilde in a typical Docker image, where does that usually point?
Good question. In most standard base images, you're running as the root user by default during the build, so resolves to root. So you'd be editing or sourcing root.bashshirk.
Okay, so putting things in root.bashshirk is fine for when you later Docker exec into the container interactively.
Exactly. For an interactive session after the image is built, root.bashshirk will be sourced as expected.
But not during the build itself using run. So what's the right way to set environment variables or paths that need to be available during the run steps?
The clean Docker idiomatic way is to use the env directive in your Docker file. Env my variable my value, or env path path.myNewPath. This sets the environment variable persistently for all subsequent build steps and for when the container eventually runs.
So env is for build time and runtime persistence, and bashshirk is mainly for interactive session setup later.
That's pretty much the standard practice, yeah. Now, if you absolutely had to run the bashshirk skips during a run command, you could force it using something like run bashshirk-c, your command here, the rla flag forces an interactive shell. But it's usually cleaner and more reliable just to use env for things needed during the build.
Got it. env for build steps, dash r for interactive use. That clears up a lot. Okay, let's move from the infrastructure plumbing to the really high-level control. How are modern systems like the Atlas framework making complex decisions, like picking the right motion in a reliable way? We hear about things like deterministic retrieval.
Yeah, this is where things are really sophisticated, moving beyond purely geometric planning. What we're seeing is a combination of techniques, often involving retrieval augmented generation, or ARG, applied to robotics, and crucially, combined with powerful visual representations like DynoV2 visual encodings.
Okay, Ryan, DynoV2, let's break that down. Why use visual encoding? What complex calculations are they trying to avoid?
They're primarily trying to avoid the brittleness and computational cost of precise geometric calculations in high-dimensional spaces, specifically things like calculating distances in SO3.
SO3, that's the space of all 3D rotations, right?
Exactly. Figuring out the closest orientation match in 3D rotation space is mathematically complex and very sensitive to noise or small errors in the robot's pose estimation or sensor readings. If your localization is off by a tiny bit, your SO3 distance calculation might give you a completely wrong answer about the best action.
Right. Localization is never perfect in the real world.
Never. So instead of relying on precise geometry, this approach uses deep learning, specifically DynoV2, which is great at learning powerful general visual features without explicit labels. The system generates a compact visual embedding, like a fingerprint, the current scene the robot sees.
A fingerprint based on what it looks like.
Yes. And then the RJ part comes in. The system has a library of pre-recorded experiences, or motion primitives, each also associated with the DynoV2 visual embedding. It compares the current scene's visual fingerprint to the library and retrieves the motion associated with the most similar visual fingerprint.
So if the world looks like this, then this action worked before, bypassing the need to know exactly where it is in global coordinates.
Pretty much. It's using visual similarity as a proxy for the appropriate action or state. It's potentially much more robust to localization drift and sensor noise because it's based on the overall visual context, not fragile geometric coordinates.
That's a fascinating shift, moving intelligence towards perception. Okay, so how does this advanced decision-making, maybe choosing a motion based on DynoV2 similarity, actually get executed? Let's talk about the Atlas framework's callback architecture you mentioned. So what does this all mean for getting commands to the robot quickly and reliably?
Right, the architecture is key here. Atlas uses this really interesting hybrid push-pull system for managing the robot's state and triggering actions. You have the pull side, which is called the System State Manager. Think of it as constantly checking for updates. It runs in separate threads and pulls the communication bus where all the sensor data and state information is flowing at a really high fixed rate. The default is 200 hertz, which is typically twice the rate the robot itself publishes its state. So it's designed not to miss anything.
Okay, pulling at 200 hertz, then what's the push part?
The push part happens inside the system state object itself. When the polling thread detects a change in state, maybe new sensor data arrives, it updates the central system state, and when that state changes, any registered callbacks associated with that specific piece of state are invoked immediately, synchronously, within that same thread that detected the change.
Synchronously. So no delay waiting for another processor loop.
Exactly. It's designed for minimal latency. And this is where a subtle but important detail comes in. They use threading, lock, instead of, say, a Syncio lock, for protecting access to this shared state.
Why that specific choice?
Speed threading. Lock is implemented in C and has incredibly low overhead, estimated around 0.001 milliseconds. A Syncio lock is pure Python and significantly slower. For high-frequency state updates happening potentially hundreds of times a second, that tiny difference matters for maintaining real-time performance.
Wow, okay. That shows a real focus on low-level performance. Now, with these kinds of multi-threaded systems, initialization order is often critical, right? Getting things started in the wrong sequence can cause chaos.
Absolutely vital. This is a crucial operational detail. The node responsible for using the state, let's call it the orchestrator node, the one that actually registers the callback functions, it must complete its initialization, including registering all its callbacks, like lines 165, 209 in the orchestrator node.py example we saw, before the system state manager starts its polling threads.
Why? What happens if the state manager starts polling first?
If the system state manager starts polling, detects an initial state change, but the orchestrator hasn't registered its callback for that state yet, that first update just gets missed. The callback never fires for that initial state. This could leave the system in an inconsistent or undefined state right from the beginning. So ensuring the listeners, callbacks, are ready before the broadcaster state manager polling starts is critical to avoid losing that crucial first piece of information.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
You need the audience in their seats before the performance starts. Okay, give us a concrete example. How does this push-pull synchronous callback system enable something like real-time teleoperation?
Right. Teleoperation is a perfect example of the event-driven synchronous part. Imagine the human operator moves the leader robot's controls. That change in the leader state is published. The system state manager pulls and detects it almost instantly, within 5 mirrors, given the 200 hertz rate. It updates the system state, and immediately, the registered on-leader state change callback function is executed synchronously. That callback function's job is simple. Take the leader state, convert it into the appropriate follower robot action, and potentially send it out right away. Because it's synchronous and low latency, you get that immediate real-time response needed for effective teleop.
Okay, so teleop is event-driven, super fast, synchronous. How does that compare to when the robot is running autonomously, say, in its AI mode?
It's a deliberate contrast. The AI mode, which might be doing more complex planning, maybe using those Dyno V2 embeddings we talked about, that typically runs in a separate asynchronous loop. In the Alice example, it runs at a slower time-driven rate, like 60 hertz. This loop periodically checks the latest state pulled by the system state manager and computes the next action based on its AI logic. It's asynchronous and slower because AI planning takes more computation, and you don't necessarily need instantaneous 200 hertz updates for longer term navigation or task execution. But the critical state updates are still flowing at 200 hertz, ready for immediate use by safety systems or the synchronous teleop callbacks if needed.
So you have this two-speed system, ultra-fast synchronous callbacks for immediate reactions like teleop, and a slower asynchronous loop for the deliberative AI brain.
Exactly. It's a hybrid architecture designed to get the best of both worlds. Responsiveness and sophisticated planning. So, if we kind of synthesize everything we've discussed today, there's a clear direction here in modern robotics, isn't there? It's all pushing towards more resilient, more scalable systems. We see it with the move to robust, decentralized communication like DDS, avoiding those single points of failure. We see it in standardizing data formats like MCP, making massive data sets manageable, indexable, and cloud-friendly. And we see it in these sophisticated control architectures like Atlas, balancing that immediate synchronous responsiveness with the more complex asynchronous intelligence needed for autonomy.
Yeah. And that underpinning theme of moving away from relying solely on rigid, fragile geometry seems really significant. This shift towards using perceptual similarity, like Dyno V2 embeddings, to drive behavior based on what the world looks like rather than just where I am in coordinates. It feels like a major change in how we approach robot control.
It definitely is. It leverages the incredible power of modern deep learning for perception.
But, you know, it does raise a question, maybe something for you, the listener, think about. As we rely more on these complex learned visual embeddings to guide robots, when things inevitably go wrong in the field, when the robot does something unexpected, does this shift towards visual similarity ultimately make it easier or perhaps harder for us humans to debug? How do you trace the reasoning of a system acting on high-dimensional visual fingerprints compared to debugging faulty coordinate transforms? What does debug visibility even look like in this more perceptual world? Something to ponder. Well, we hope this deep dive gave you some valuable, practical insights into the powerful engine driving modern robotics today. Thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.